This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. And I'm joined by Martin and Chris this week. How are you guys? How are you doing?
Hello, Chris. I'm doing fine. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris. And hi, Chris. Happy New Year, everybody.
Oh, yes. And to you. Well, we're a few days in, aren't we?
Well, supposedly in France, it's acceptable to wish people Happy New Year to the end of January. So if you've got any French listeners, they can confirm or deny this.
Well, I lived in France for 3 years and I don't honestly remember what you did. That's a bit naughty of me, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the wine, Chris.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Anyway, moving on. You've just highlighted the fact, Martin, that it is the start of a new year. It is 2020. And we did our sort of recap of the success or not of our predictions a couple of weeks ago. And actually, we didn't really make any serious predictions. We just talked about the industry. You didn't make that one, Chris, because you were off, I think, gallivanting in the US again. You know, one of your trips.
I was.
But thankfully,
on a lovely IT press tour, meeting a lot of startups.
Yes, and doing lots of writing about it, I guess. Or not, you know, maybe you didn't like them. Maybe you didn't write anything about them at all. I couldn't say.
They're a lovely bunch of people.
Good, wonderful. Well, let's do our stuff then and see if we can go through and work out what we think is going to happen in 2020. Now, I sort of just...
In storage, that is.
Oh, yeah, okay.
We're predicting what's happening in storage. We're not predicting what anybody else is going to do. Because who knows at the moment?
That is a good point, actually. I should have said enterprise data storage as well, even more to qualify that, because you know we don't know what's happening in the the general sort of storage industry for keeping stuff in lockups and things like that. So,
true.
So we should step away from all of that and talk about enterprise storage. Now, I made a list of things. I think Chris, you provided a few things. So we'll wander through the list, see what we think, and then. You know, we might add some, we might take some away. Let's see how we get on. But the first area is to talk about media. Now, before we started recording, this might be relevant, Chris. You talked about a fire, actually. Do you want to go back over that again? And then we'll dive into QLC and see what that relevance that has to the discussion.
Sure thing. There's been a fire this morning at a Kioxia flash foundry in Japan. Nobody was hurt. The fire's been put out. But the clean room in this Fab 6 is out of action while it's been inspected and the damage assessed. It would seem that all flash wafers downstream of the clean room are going to be okay and production can continue, but all production upstream of the clean room will have to wait until the clean room's fixed. It's for 64 and 96 layer flash, so it is current flash. And Kioxia apparently is responsible for up to 3% of the world's flash production. So there may be a hiccup in NAND supply with a consequent rise in prices.
You know, when we used to say with things like Spectrum Protect and stuff like that, we'd go TSM. Who were Kioxia beforehand?
Toshiba Memory Corporation.
Right.
So it's Toshiba's flash memory, which is in a joint venture with Western Digital. It got sold off by Toshiba to private equity, a bunch of private equity people, then renamed itself Kioxia, bought itself more or less out of private equity and is still in a flash foundry partnership with Western Digital.
Okay, so that might have an impact, but at the end of the day, the comment on here was to say, what do we think is going to happen in 2020? I think maybe the first thing is to think that prices might go up.
Yeah, I think prices the market seems to be stabilizing. A trough bottom has been reached, and it looks like prices will go up quite steadily during 2020.
Yeah, I have a conspiracy theory. We seem to get one of these every year, and I just wonder if it's a way of the NAND manufacturers trying to manage the bottom price.
You think it's an insurance job?
I do. It's a double insurance job. Not only are they going to get some money back, but it's also they'll get a nice increase and they'll start making bigger margins. So I think they engineer this.
Do you reckon they ring up their insurance company and go, "We've had this thing happen," and the insurance company is saying, "You do know this is all recorded. This is all, you know, so if we want to go back over this, this conversation's recorded."
And then they turn around and say, "Oh, yeah, that's fine because it's all recorded on our media. So keep
yeah,
recording."
Yeah, good point. Okay, Chris, what would you say then in terms of how much you think this is going to affect the industry? Minor, major?
minor, small potatoes, I think.
Yeah, fair enough.
Unless there's some dreadful problem that puts the clean room out of action for weeks.
Yeah, fair enough. But what about QLC in general? You know, we've seen, 96 layers. There's talk about 144. So, you know, that technology is going to keep on growing, isn't it?
SK Hynix is sampling 128-layer flash at the moment. Micron says it has 128-layer flash scheduled for production later this year. So I don't see any reason why the layers shouldn't increase.
And that increases capacity?
And flash capacity's
gone. Yeah, that increases capacity. Do you remember quite a few years ago, you and I were downstairs at the VMworld conference in Barcelona? And anybody who knows that conference area knows that there's a set of escalators that takes you downstairs to a quiet area, and then you walked into the big conference area. And I remember you and I having a discussion talking about NAND and saying that, and I think you were saying that for some reason we saw a gap and that NAND was going to not scale to take all the demand of data around the world. But that doesn't really seem to have played out, does it?
No, it doesn't. I think the twin effects of increasing bit counts in cells and increasing the layer counts in dies is sending NAND capacity up, skyrocketing. There doesn't seem to be any practical limit to it at the moment.
So we don't have to worry about a shortage in that sense then. We're still going to have the capacity to deal with it. I guess maybe price affects that though, Martin.
Yeah, I imagine so. That's interesting. You're just talking about the impact this might have on, firewall have on prices. I bought a new SSD just earlier this week and it's gone up £5 in price.
You don't normally see that, do you?
Today, no. I don't normally see. I mean, but they can be a little bit of fluctuation, but I don't normally expect to see things just suddenly shift. It's consumer flash, but I don't imagine this might actually impact it. And you never know. Suddenly, you see these things happen. People feel that there's going to be a constraint in supply, so as a few people decide, okay, I'm just going to bump the price a little bit.
Okay, moving on. PLC. Everybody seems to think that this might be a thing, but I'm not really sure whether I think it will be.
It's gone from being, oh, we'll never do it, to, yes, of course it's going to happen in about 3 months. So when QLC, the 4-bit cell flash, started getting established, really well established in the middle of last year, then PLC raised its head as a possibility. And the idea that you'd be able to pick out one electric voltage level from 32 levels to find out the bit value of a 5-bit cell flash seemed nonsense. And now Western Digital people are talking blithely about, oh, we can do that. We'll have controllers with machine learning models in them, and PLC flash will be quite feasible in a year or two's time.
I don't know. Are you going to say something there, Martin?
I was going to say, it really depends how it's going to drive down the price. If it drives down the price, it might have a future as a write once, read many times. So it's sort of in archive, maybe somewhere you're going to stick all your Splunk analytics for analysis going forward. I think for general purpose flash, QLC is probably about the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. But I so it'd be interesting to see if PLC actually has this. And it's really going to have to come down to life cycle, isn't it? Whether it really has the endurance we expect. Because we are really beginning. If you look up the tables which show endurance cycles, it really starts to see a drop. Obviously, SLC is the best endurance. MLC is not too bad compared to that. And then you start seeing these big drops to TLC, QLC. Then PLC. PLC may have, it's not horrendous compared to QLC, but it might be just that little bit worse.
Could be too far.
So you might think, you know what, I'm not going to risk it. Yeah, but we know the flash manufacturers will keep pushing things. They want to keep this cycle going. But maybe PLC is the last we get for the time being.
Oh heavens! If you had something after PLC, its endurance and its speed, I think, would be so horribly slow, and the complexity of the controllers. That would be 64 voltage levels to sort out, wouldn't it? Horrendous.
Yeah, maybe the next generation after PLC is the tape replacement, the final tape replacement.
So I would question. I would say I'd question a couple of things there. First of all, obviously we know that we get diminishing returns as we only add an extra bit into the capacity. So obviously, with 4 bits going to 5, then you're only sort of getting that 20% gain rather than the 100% gain that I got with. What we got with going from SLC to MLC when we effectively doubled the capacity. But from the things that I've seen, first of all, Pete Kirkpatrick, who was on the podcast with us before Christmas, he said he'd seen the presentation about PLC at, I think you might have said it was Flash Memory Summit. I can't remember which event it was. And it seemed to be that PLC was being used almost like a discovery area to work out how to fix some of the problems that might then be pushed back into QLC, so we just make better QLC. And I know that, Chris, you've published a graph on one of your recent articles, which actually showed the different levels of endurance depending on the cell size. So depending on the actual manufacturing size, you've got better quality. So it may well be that what we end up doing is we end up sort of compromising on increasing cell size to get better endurance, and then we change after that. And third, I think I might have said two things, but there is a third one. You may have seen that in Motus yesterday announced a hybrid drive, which is basically SLC flash and QLC flash on the same physical drive with a controller managing the balance of active data between the two. So effectively, it's using machine learning, ML, AI type stuff to move the actual active data back and forth between the SLC and the QLC. And, you know, that might make PLC possibly attractive if we use that sort of hybrid function, as long as the costs actually still stack up.
I think it's a fascinating area, because increasing the cell's bit count gives us progressively lower returns. One bit added to 4 bits is not as effective as adding 1 bit to 3 bits.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the layer count's going up. So the two things together mean that the capacities on a die can shoot up, even if we only get minor increases in capacity per cell. We get so much increase from the extra layers that the two combined give us an enormous increase in capacity.
Mm. Well, I'll use that as a segue into the next topic, and that's really the idea of 20 plus terabyte hard drives, because what we just talked about in terms of techniques and other things that are used to extend the life and the capacity of flash, we've seen that in the hard drive industry for years, and that still seems to be moving on and on and on.
Yes. We've got Western Digital sampling its 18 terabyte and 20 terabyte drives at the moment with some elements of its MAMA, microwave assisted magnetic recording technology, in it. We got Seagate demonstrating a live drive at CES with 18 terabyte HAMR drives inside it, which are not yet in production. And both Western Digital and Seagate see themselves bringing out 40 terabyte plus drives in a couple of years. It seems like they can just carry on increasing capacity again and again. However, the ability to get data onto and off these drives seems to be stuck at the one actuator level. Multi-actuator drives with two actuators will increase it 1.5, 1.7 times perhaps, but the idea of having a 40 terabyte drive which with the same actuator scheme as a 20 terabyte drive is pretty poor in terms of IO density.
Is that any different to a tape though, in terms of the density?
Well, it's got to be better than a tape, hasn't it? Because you only have one drive motor, one read-write recording head per tape, whereas at least with these multi-actuator drives, you'll have two, and the drives logically split into two half drives.
So I did make a comment, you know, to say, are hard drives really the new tape? And that was sort of tongue-in-cheek, really, to a certain degree. But you can sort of see, to a certain degree, hard drives acting almost like a sort of semi-offline capability rather than just being purely offline like tape is, Martin, I would have said.
Yeah, it's possible, Chris, but we remember the issue with hard drives is we know when hard drives fail, and that's when they spin up, spin down. So tape is fantastic because tape, you don't spin up, spin down. You don't have to worry about that. It's environmentally, it's very good. You can get very good storage densities. If you actually look at the magnetic densities on a tape media compared to a hard drive, I mean, a tape is a lot less dense. There's a long way for IBM especially to go with what they could probably put on a tape if they really wanted to. So
tape is a new tape.
Tape is a new tape. People keep talking about the death of tape. And at the moment, it doesn't. For if you want an offline archive and you want a long-term data retention, it looks like tape's still where you want to be.
I've got a question for you there, Martin, because you still deal with, well, you have people who deal with tape. You don't lower yourself to actually deal with it yourself, but you have people who do that on your behalf. And I haven't used tape for a few years. Let's say LTO2 was the last one I had in the lab, and I remember 3480 when I used to find that the ends would come off the actual the leader that would, you know, come out of the cartridge. But how reliable do you find those devices these days compared to what they used to be? Are they getting more reliable? Do you see lots of failures? Or, you know, can you really afford to put that much data on one tape and be happy?
Well, being as you know, I work in media, if you haven't got two copies, got a copy. So you generally have two copies. We do have a special tool for replacing leader pins. So actually we do have a tool. IBM gave it to us because we had enough. There was an issue with, I think, early life LTO5. We had a whole load of leader pins pop, and they eventually got so fed up of it, they gave us a tool. It looks like the inside of a toilet roll.
It has little
cogs, and you can unwind the tape a little bit and reseat the pin and put it back in again. The tapes generally, we've got a lot of tape, so we see a few failures, but we have over 30,000 tapes. We're expecting to see some failures. If we were probably to do the maths, you'd probably find that tape from a failure point of view is more reliable than hard drive.
No, fair enough. Because I just don't know. I mean, I'm out of touch with knowing the level of reliability. And obviously, if you do have a tape failure, it's copying the whole tape again, isn't it? You're replicating from another copy in its entirety. It makes no sense to try and just replace the failed data like you would do on a hard drive.
Yeah, as hard drives get bigger, that failure zone is getting larger as well. So if you lost a 20 terabyte hard drive or 40 terabyte hard drive, that's a huge amount of data to try and recover.
That is true. Now, from my perspective, I wonder whether when you look at the size of the drives and the capacities and the cost of putting in additional actuators and so on, whether the manufacturers have looked at the cost of things like multiple controllers, failover controllers, like a redundant controllers and things like that, to see whether things like that might be worth justifying in order to make sure that they can continue to increase the reliability of the drives. Because, as you said, Chris, they've got to do something to sort of, I guess, mitigate our concerns about the fact that copying data on and off is so slow.
I'm thinking that, off at a slight tangent, forgive me, but I'm thinking this time last year, we were probably thinking that disk drives were going to make more of an assault on tape, and that Optane media was going to make more of an assault on the gap between DRAM and NAND. And basically, neither of those two things have come to pass. We had a storage hierarchy at the beginning of 2019, and here we are at the beginning of 2020 with exactly the same storage hierarchy. And it doesn't seem likely that it's actually going to change this year either much. I don't personally think disk drive reliability is much of an issue. The failure rate for disk drives, so if you look at Backblaze's hard drive statistics, are astonishingly low, down 1%. It's less than 1% in some instances. It's tremendous technology.
So here's a question for you. Who was it said? Was it Bill Gates that said people overestimate what will happen in 12 months or 1 year, but they underestimate what will change in 10 years? I think it was a Bill Gates quote. But maybe the fact that we look at this on an annual basis and we think things might change dramatically, actually, in fact, they never do. But if we went back and looked at this over 10 years, then we would see a very different scenario. And Martin and I sort of touched on this a little bit a couple of weeks ago when we were sort of saying, you look back at where we were 10 years ago, we were talking about 1 terabyte drives, and now we're talking about 20. We didn't have flash. We didn't have 3D XPoint. We didn't have any of those other types of technologies really to that degree, like MRAM or any of those sort of things. So on a 10-year cycle, we've seen a lot of change, but maybe 1 year is too short to measure this.
And the cleverness lies in looking at the various things that are happening, like MRAM developments and Optane and so forth, and working out somehow that, yes, these things will fly. They have longevity, whereas other things, putting compute in solid-state storage drives, for instance, isn't going to fly at all. I don't know how to pick out the winners from the losers.
Yeah, it's hard, though, isn't it, Martin? I mean, we talk about this week in, week out, and you look at trying to work out who's going to be successful in all of this.
Yeah, I think sometimes we have to look at technology and see how it would be deployed. I mean, especially take Chris's point about Optane. Optane's interesting because I think one of the reasons that Optane's adoption has been slower is the changes to use Optane properly that you have to make at a fundamental operating system level. And it means that people can have to understand how their systems perform differently. The rapid change into SSDs really was not a massive architectural change. You could just swap them out, and you'd have something which was faster. We can argue about in the enterprise arrays whether that was the right thing to do and whether you got the most out of it, but it was easy. And when we start going to Optane, you can't retrate like a hard drive because you just can't get the densities at the moment. They don't exist. So architecturally, things need to change. So I think we were probably very enthusiastic and cheerleaders for things like Optane. And now if you look back at it, that might have been a bit rash. But I think in 10 years' time, we assume we're still recording in 10 years' time, we'll look back at things, well, it happened. There was a sudden change, the software, the applications caught up, and it was the obvious thing to do. So I think, actually, you were talking about quotes. William Gibson once said, the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. So, and that's true. The future is, if you go into some place, if you look at, say, Linux and Windows, they do support Optane and they support it in the right way, but it's just not being distributed very well yet. We'll see it happen, I'm sure.
Perhaps it's a Gartner hype cycle effect here, with start of last year, Optane being close to the initial peak of the hype cycle. And now it's gone down to the bottom. It's climbing up out of it. But eventually it will go past the peak and become a very popular technology.
You have to remember, Chris, but there is no empirical evidence behind the Gartner hype cycle. The Gartner hype cycle itself is a hype. But yeah, I take your point. I think you're right.
So let's get gnomic here. Where is the hype cycle on the hype cycle?
I think it's overhyped, actually.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay, right then. Let's wrap this section up on media. And I think we can summarize this by saying incremental change every year. We're going to keep on seeing it. Over a 10-year period, that's a better way of looking at this. And actually, maybe I should go away and try and work it out, how we're going to measure it. But we should look at it and say, when did 3D Crosspoint come in? How long has it been out there? And really, what's happened over its lifetime? Because over its lifetime is probably a better indication than anything else at the moment, because it's not been in the market long enough for us to care. And I did say, you know, it's funny how disc and tape still hangs in. And I did have a question to say, do we think older or slower media eventually becomes the archive tier? But actually, when I looked at it, I thought, well, we're not using punch cards anymore, and we're not using ferrite core. And then I suddenly thought, I wonder if we are. I wonder if there's anybody who's actually still using punch cards somewhere. There probably is.
Yes, Amazon's Deep Glacier Archive is actually an Iron Mountain vault full of old punch cards.
Cards, right, okay. There you go. Cost effective. Yeah, but you certainly don't want to fire in it like you had in your NAND. In your NAND fab, do you? That certainly wouldn't help things. There you go. I tell you what, it might help TravelX this week. You know, at least you couldn't hack it, could you, if it's all on punch cards? You couldn't encrypt the data.
Well, there's a new technology for punch cards. They're now having them layered.
Layered punch cards.
We have a 3D stack of punch cards.
Like Jenga.
Yeah, you could back them up, though. You could stick them through a knitting machine. So they used to take punch cards. So you could stick them through a jacquard loom or something. That could be your backup. It could be this wonderful woven tapestry.
You could weave data into a sweater? No, stop it. I'm not going there.
Yeah, you could. Density would be rubbish, but yeah.
I think we should move on and talk about systems before we get. Do you know what? You can tell it's a new year, can't you? All the Christmas frivolity still hanging in. Let's move on and talk about systems. And this is a couple that I think you'd might have pushed us in this direction, Chris, and that's to talk about things like composable and rack scale and so on. And I sort of extended this a little bit and said, why have those technologies not been as readily adopted as, say, HCI was? And that maybe that's, you know, related to the discussion we just had about 3D Crosspoint and its adoption compared to SSDs. So why don't you give us the benefit of your wisdom on this area?
Yeah, I think Martin put his finger on this, that flash adoption was easy because it was really a plug-in replacement for disk drives, forcing the issue a little bit, whereas Optane is not a plug-in replacement for anything. I think composable systems sound to me like an absolutely great idea. Instead of having 50 individual servers, each with their own CPU, memory, storage, and networking, and so on, I'll have one massive server and carve it up via software means into ones I need for particular workloads. But that seems to me actually an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. And there's a granularity thing. If I'm looking at my big, massive server, and the granularity is that I can carve it up in 20% lumps of compute or 20% lumps of storage or DRAM, but I actually need sub-10% changes. If I need, say, 5% of this, if the granularity of the control isn't fine enough, then composable systems aren't going to do me any good at all, because I'll still have wasted and stranded capacity. Yep. And I also think that ensuring you get a good rate of use out of the components is also going to be very, very difficult. How can you know with a composable system that over a period of time, you're going to get a certain minimum level of use out of the compute cores, the disk drives, the flash drives, the network switches, and so on? And I don't think you can, because it's going to be workload dependent. So people will start trying to match a composable system to a suite of applications. It just leaves me thinking, these things are just there for hyperscalers, really. If I've got 100 servers, then a composable system probably isn't worthwhile. If I've got 10,000 server-based system, then a composable system probably really is worthwhile, because the improvements in efficiency I get will be so great at that level. But for the rest of us, for the non-hyperscalers, I think composable systems might be a figment of our imagination. They may not fly at all.
Any opinions, Martin, before I chime in?
Well, we were at Discover when HP started talking about composable systems, yeah, or more, and as we like to call them, as compostable, which is a bit unfair. But I think one of the problems is, there are two things. It is a technical challenge. I don't think anybody really understands them and don't understand how to use them. But the marketing around it has been terrible. And anybody looking at it from the outside would say, well, surely that's just Nutanix. Surely it's just an HCI system given a different name. So nobody's done a very good job at distinguishing them from an HCI.
Yeah. Well, I wrote something actually towards the end of last year talking about this. And the one company that I've seen that looks like they could be interesting so far in this area is a company called Liquid. And the reason I think they're interesting is because they're connecting all the devices together using a PCI Express backbone,
yes,
which is low latency, high performance. And therefore, if you were trying to build a server where you were putting in, say, GPUs or other types of more bespoke and specific devices, it would be potentially really useful, because you could add them in, use them for 24 hours, do what you need to do, and put them somewhere else. You'd have to be pretty hot on reorganizing that and making efficient use of it. But so far, that's about the only platform I can see that's got the flexibility and the low latency and the performance to make it work. You know, you mentioned HPE and their system, but that's composable from a sense of connecting storage across a network to existing physical servers. We certainly can't say, here's a processor, or here's 10 processors, let's put them together and then call that a machine, and then 2 minutes later let's split it into 2 5 CPUs. But you know what, we could do that 30 years ago on the mainframe. I'm sorry to say it, but we could do.
And I thought you were going to bring that up. I thought you were going to bring up Sysplex. It's Sysplex, and parallel Sysplex.
It's what Amdahl invented, first of all. And then IBM then went back and re-engineered their systems to produce LPARs and the ability to map. In fact, in the Amdahl implementations, you could actually split a physical processor up into logical ones cross domain, and you could oversubscribe. So it was a bit more advanced. But you know, that technology has been around, and it only existed like it did because everything was in one massive monolithic system. And we had other examples of technology like that. The SunSpark machines could do that. Like the E10Ks, E25Ks, they could do that to a certain degree. So the technology's existed and been out there and been used. But I think you're right, Chris, there's got to be enough of a reason for you to want to chop and change in your environment to make this really worthwhile.
I think HCI systems, the hyperconverged bits, have a wide appeal across a range of enterprise sizes, whereas composable systems, to my mind, are only going to be appealing to the hyperscaler people, because they're the only people who have thousands and thousands of components and can get efficiencies out of their use that other people can't.
I'm going to throw one into the mix here, a company that I've spoken to already. They're UK-based, they're based in Cambridge. They're called Bamboo Systems. Have you spoken to them at all? So they are doing ARM-based servers. Funny enough, their chairman, I think it is Jeff Barrell from the old Connected Data and Drobo days. And obviously...
Bamboo. Yes. Bamboo, yes. Now, this is a strange company.
But they could be interesting from the point of view that what they're doing is they're producing ARM-based servers that have to have some sort of high-speed mesh interconnect. Now, I'm not entirely sure how that mesh is configured, but imagine you could actually create a mesh of processes together that can act as a system, how configurable will that mesh be? If that mesh was highly configurable, you maybe could create logical sort of servers within a physical server framework. And that might be a way to do some of what we've just been talking about. Whether that's possible or not, I don't know. But I'm really interested to see whether something like that might be the way that we move it forward.
Maybe one of the things that you can detect if you look at IT with in 10-year chunks is that ARM becoming useful in enterprise servers is one of these 10-year chunk effects that year by year, it doesn't seem as if it's going to happen. Possibly when we look in 5 years' time, ARM servers will be very popular indeed.
I think they will be. Absolutely, I think they will be.
I'm not seeing it at the moment. I've spoken to ARM so many times, and I'm not seeing it. I think everybody's waiting. Certainly in the enterprise corporate space, is waiting for somebody like Dell or HPE, somebody else to start building servers using ARM components. And I think if that happens, yeah, then we might see it happen. But until they're embraced by one of the big boys, I don't see it at the moment.
Yeah, well, it's needed. Amazon to do it themselves, isn't it, to actually take the reference design and create the Graviton 1 last year, Graviton 2 this year, processors that are based, well, the new one's based off Neoverse designs. The previous one was based off the Cortex A72 design, which is similar-ish to what's in your Raspberry Pi, really, but except that's a system on a chip.
Could you contribute to my education, please? If you have containerized software, Can those containers be ported readily from an x86 system to an ARM system?
You have to recompile the app.
Yeah, you have to recompile. So it's exactly the same situation which we are today. If you run Linux on a Raspberry Pi or any one of the ARM servers, the applications, you can recompile, but you can't move it natively. Well, not easily. There are ways you can do it, but you'd always take a performance hit, so you'd always want to compile it natively, certainly on an ARM, which has less performance than the equivalent Intel. Architecture.
Okay, so containerization isn't a sly way for ARM processors to slip into the enterprise data center.
Well, Kubernetes allows you to orchestrate across ARM and Intel-based servers relatively easy. So as long as you have a container image, it's fine. So you could actually have a service which ran quite happily on the Intel and ARM, and it was just a recompiled version of the same application. We've had cross-architecture type schedulers for a long time. IBM had one which would allow you to run workloads on RISC-based servers and SGI-based servers in a supercomputing environment. So it's been around, but this hybrid architecture within a data center hasn't really taken off. Even to the extent, if you look at most data centers, you don't see a big mix of Intel and AMD. Although we might start to see that happen now with the latest AMD chips because of your power price ratio is so much better on them at the moment.
Okay, just to add one little bit to that, I think if you look at the difference between, say, Intel and AMD in terms of the way that the processors work, obviously we know that ARM is a RISC-based design. So the background to that is that you expect the more efficient and smaller instruction set to be executed quicker or in fewer clock cycles than you would do if it was a CISC system like Intel, a complex instruction set. And as a result, the Intel systems are great in a straight line. If you've got a single threaded application, they have the high performance because they execute the instructions much quicker because they've got a higher clock speed. Whereas with the ARM processors, you've got a much more power efficient solution that's probably suited more readily to scaling, let's call it scaling out rather than scaling up. And therefore, if you've got a distributed system like something that runs thousands of containers, that might be more suitable to the ARM architecture than it would be to the Intel architecture. So Amazon are looking at it for things like, I think for some of their load balancers and things like that, where they know they're handling many, many threads and they're trying to distribute those threads across many cores, but they need a low power processor to do that because there's other interrupts going on in the background. So I can see there's a definite use for it, but you really do have to understand your application to know where it will work and where it won't.
Do you, Martin and Chris, think that the way hyperscalers use IT is diverging more and more away from the way that enterprises use IT? And that the hyperscaler computing model will become less and less applicable to enterprises in terms of implementing boxes of hardware?
I think they're very different already, how you implement it. But functionally, the way an enterprise will consume it or how a developer will consume it is identical. So we're seeing some very different architectural modules, but that's not necessarily a big problem because it's scale. The hyperscaler scale is so different to a lot of enterprises that you have to implement in different ways.
Yeah. So if you look at, say, the technology that Amazon developed with Nitro, they went off and decided that there was more value to developing bespoke hardware there that they could offload things like networking and storage functionality to, and security, of course, in order to gain more efficiency from the actual servers themselves at scale. And clearly for them, maybe 5%, 3%, who knows what, 10%, whatever the saving is a significant cost saving for them compared to, I guess, most other enterprises, unless you're really large. Now, the question is, why is that technology not being developed by people like Dell and HP? Why have we not seen an equivalent type technology? And I wonder whether we'll see things like that. So if you've not seen it, there's a new startup on the block from a couple of famous names, a company called Oxide Computer, and they're looking to take the open compute definitions that people like Facebook developed and actually build those into systems that you could deploy in your own data center. So give you the sort of the hardware infrastructure that people at Amazon have got so that you could deploy that yourselves without having to go down the route of outposts. My wonder there, though, is the software side of it as well.
I'm beginning to think that IT supply could split into companies that supply the hyperscalers and companies that supply enterprises. And the reason that Dell and others didn't develop this Nitro hardware is because they're focused on selling systems to enterprises and enterprises don't want it. And there are no specialized companies developing this kind of hardware just looking at Amazon or Facebook or Google, because to succeed, they'd have to sell tens of thousands of pieces of kit to five customers. Yeah. And it's a horrible, horrible business model, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a massive risk.
Well, HPE did do a couple of things, didn't they? So they did, wasn't the Apollo meant to be like a more lightweight server model? And of course, Moonshot, which was definitely more lightweight. But I don't know whether they've been successful. Yeah.
But it failed. The Hewlett-Packard as far as R&D and developing advanced IT architecture is concerned, HPE is a catastrophe. The machine is a risible effort in hindsight. I think composable systems, I fear, are going to go the same way. And HPE just progresses its offer by basically buying up other companies.
Okay. Oh well. So we've put the knife in the back of composable systems and in that discussion.
Compostable systems, they're going to be recycled as mainframes.
So I think that's probably a pretty good point to say end of part one. Keep listening, everybody, and we'll start part two soon.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.